You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 23rd of March 2023 on Monocle 24.
Uganda courts what would be richly merited pariah status. The countries which invaded Afghanistan two decades ago review the conduct of some of their soldiers. And do AI chatbots have a liberal bias, or is this entirely a figment of the fevered imaginations of overly online conservatives? And who cares? I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Lynn O'Donnell and Ivor Gaber will discuss all the day's big stories, and we'll bring you Henry Rhys Sheridan's latest letter from New York City. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I'm joined in the studio today by Lynn O'Donnell, columnist for Foreign Policy magazine, and Ivor Gaber, professor of political journalism at the University of Sussex. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Good evening.
Lynn, as our many regular, like we have any other kind listeners, will be aware, you were going to go to Venice, and you're back. How was it?
It was an interminable lead-up, wasn't it?
It really was. Yeah, so this had better be good.
Well, it was fabulous, but, you know, there was a sadness about it as well, because as the Venetian man who was sitting next to me on the plane, both going and coming back, you couldn't make that up, said to me, we turned our city into a Disneyland. And there was very much that feeling about it. But beyond the dislocation, I guess, of the local people, it's sensationally beautiful. Every corner of it is beautiful, and the art was sensational and the food was great, but there was no connection with the people.
Yeah, I was struck a bit by that when I went a few years ago, stupidly, for the first time. But I was mostly struck by the beauty of it and the improbableness of it. And I just kept thinking of the meeting that must have taken place 600 or 700 years ago, and just admiring the salesmanship of whichever Italian nobleman it was who first pitched to his colleagues, lads, let's build a town full of palaces in the middle of the swamp.
Yeah.
Because somebody must have said, but we've got land. And he's like, no, we must do this in the middle of the swamp. And instead of streets, we'll have water. And everyone went, right, fine, let's do it.
Let's do it.
It was the Doge what done it.
It was the Doge. You have been, Ivor, I understand it, in East Finchley, very much the Venice of the... No, that's not going to work. But you've been in East Finchley.
I have been in East Finchley, and there I was, minding my business on last Friday, going for a coffee with a chum to our usual coffee place, and there were crowds there. And as we approached the crowds, there was music. And there was Irish stew, and there was Guinness, and there was dancing, and it was St. Patrick's Day, and I knew nothing about it.
But I spent... like two of those five things.
Guinness.
The Guinness and the Irish stew, the crowds and music and dancing, oh, who needs any of that?
It was that Irish dancing, yeah, you know, the river dance, plump, plump, plump. And I developed a taste for Guinness, which I thought I'd lost. For the last 30 years, I said, I don't like Guinness. I do like Guinness. It was lovely. And I went home very merry.
Well, today's edition of the Daily, apparently brought to you by Guinness. We will have more from Lynn and Ivor shortly, but we will be starting with the travails currently being endured by the proprietors of infernally addictive distraction contraption, TikTok. Here in the UK, TikTok has been banned from government-issued phones, following similar prescriptions in Norway, the Netherlands, Denmark, Canada and Belgium. This news was announced a few hours ago as TikTok CEO Shaozi Chu was testifying before the Congress of the United States amid growing security concerns about his platform as the Biden administration threatens to ban it entirely. Well, I'm joined now by Monocle's US editor, Chris Lord. Chris, what did we learn from Shao's testimony today?
So the testimony to the House Energy and Commerce Committee was profoundly combative. The congresspeople who were there really didn't hold back in their fears and their criticisms of a company that many say is simply too infiltrated into American daily life given that it is essentially Beijing headquartered from its parent company, ByteDance. But Shaoxi Chu, you know, he really held his own to some extent against the sort of accusations that, if anything, this data that had been accumulated on American users, of which he said that there was around 150 million of them, which you, to some extent, seems extraordinary, given that's almost about half of all Americans. But given how popular it is, it's probably not too far from the reality. But what we did learn, I think, is that, you know, TikTok claims to have built a huge firewall that will keep US data in the US. It claims to have an extraordinary legion of people moderating its content. And it also claims that, if anything, its entanglement with the Chinese Communist Party is not as deep and as meaningful as these various members of Congress would like to say. Watching the hearing today, what struck me was that actually a lot of the discourse really was the kind of things that you could level at any of the big social media companies. Too much data being taken and held by these large companies on their users, poor content moderation that means that toxic content gets seen by very young people, and also widely overused. You mentioned, you know, the sheer time sink that TikTok, you know, infamously is. People spending hours and hours on this thing, scrolling through endless amounts of video. And I think also, you know, those two points could be leveled at Instagram or any of the other major video, short video sites that are out there. I think the crux of the thing that we still haven't learned, and this is what strikes me, is that if the US government and the administration of President Joe Biden is considering banning this, it needs to reveal exactly what national security and intelligence knows about this app. Because we hear vague concerns about data going to China. We hear vague concerns about potential key login, so password stealing or stealing intellectual property and so on. But it's only concerns I'm worried about, and never this is what we know is happening. And that, I think, so close to so many Americans' lives, is very worrying. And we still don't have those answers after this hearing today.
Chris, you mentioned that he had taken a combative, as you put it, tone with the Congressional Committee. In light of the stakes in play, was that wise?
Look, I think he was on the defensive. I think the committee was very combative. I think there is a general feeling now that Biden's going to have to make a call on this one way or the other. Let's not forget that this began during the Donald Trump era, who then threatened to ban TikTok if it didn't divest itself and sell to an American company. So Joe Biden has really picked up that ball and now having to run with it. Unfortunately, it's gone so far now along the line that he's got no choice and he has to make a statement and a clear line forward going forward, not least because both sides of the House, what unites this extremely divided Congress is a bipartisan hawkishness towards China. And that was on full display today. I mean, the Congress people did not hold back. And their exasperations, as I say, seem to be more with social media as a thing rather than necessarily the entanglement with China. But what you do get come away from all this watching it today is just, we just don't really know a great deal about this company. And actually, given what we've learned today, despite some of their, you know, Shaoxi Chu, as I say, really tried to hold his own and was very defensive about what the company had done to put in place to reassure Americans that it was a safe and not hostile company tied to the Communist Party of China and so on. Despite all that, really, we learned those mechanisms, but we still don't really know about its relationship with the Chinese government. We don't know any more at the end of this today.
Chris Lord, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. We will bring in our panel now, Ivor and Lynn, and we will start with Uganda, which now finds itself dealing with the tedium of reaping after having all the fun of sowing. Yesterday, Uganda's parliament cheered the passing of anti-gay legislation, as vicious as it is idiotic. Under new provisions, identifying oneself as gay risks life imprisonment, and friends and families of people in same-sex relationships are obliged to report them to authorities. Indeed, a reporter who scripted a broadcast such as this, even mentioning the subject of homosexuality, could be looking at 20 years. The US, for one, has suggested that if Uganda's president, Yoweri Museveni, does not intercede to keep this nonsense off the books, Uganda could find itself on the receiving end of sanctions it can ill afford. Ivor, first of all, I'm not going to ask you to speak for Uganda's parliament here, but from the point of view of Uganda's parliament, do we apprehend the point of any of this, or is it just a straightforward enactment of fairly profound bigotry?
It is the latter. It is the latter, but I spent some time, I lived in Uganda significant number of years ago, and there's this dualism in the population that there are very warm, friendly people, but scratch the surface, there are some horrendous attitudes going on there. Mm. I'm not sure it's going to go through, because Museveni's a wily old fox. Not a nice man, I think, but a wily old fox. And I think that the American rumblings might just cause him to kick it into the ubiquitous long grass, because I don't think he wants to risk US aid on this particular issue.
And just to follow that up quickly, you describe Yoweri Museveni as a wily old fox, which is all true, but the operative word where Museveni is concerned is increasingly old, and he has been in power a very long time. And how convinced are we he still has all his marbles in one sock?
I think he does, and he has lined up his son to take over, which is traditional, the usual thing. He's also pretty ruthless. There was a, in the last election, the candidate who, of course, ended up in jail, as the leading opposition did, was a young liberal DJ who certainly wouldn't have been sharing these sort of attitudes. And I think Museveni felt really threatened about the new wave coming along. So maybe this parliament is his to control. There was, it was a brutal, as elections in Uganda have been, it was a brutal campaign. It could well be that I don't think they would have put this show on, so to speak, had Museveni not approved of it. But now, having approved of it, I think he might have bitten off more than he can chew. And we'll be kicking it into the long grass, to mix my metaphors fatally.
That is a shocker, Ivor. That reminds me of my insufferable habit when I was an editor and people used to send in a copy which had a metaphor mixed quite like that in it. I used to ring them up and ask them to draw the metaphor and then fax it to me, as was the style at the time, which did decorate my cubicle, interestingly, I have to say. We'll forgive you this once. Lynn, is there an argument against sanctioning Uganda into the middle of next week over this?
I can't think of one. But, you know, once what this cat is out of the bag, and it doesn't matter.
It's metaphor day
so,
on the
yes,
daily.
It is. Yeah.
And don't kick it into the long grass, because the animal lovers won't like it.
But I think that whether the law passes or not, and whether it is kicked into the long grass in order to make sure that the money keeps flowing, the stigmatisation is already there. There has been a campaign leading up to this.
This is not news entirely, no.
Indeed. And also, Uganda is not the only country where the issue of homosexuality and the stigmatisation of homosexuals and the possibility that vulnerable people can be targeted and blackmailed and all of that exists in 69 countries across the world, and half of them are in Africa. So Uganda is not an outlier. It's just the most obvious, and it is today's bad place to be yourself.
there is, and for goodness sake, don't interpret this as a defence of the Ugandan position, but there is a certain delicacy here. It could look like, to many people, here are the old imperialists telling a democratically elected government what it should be doing.
Democratically is doing a bit of work there, isn't it?
And electing them. But it's the, you know, America and to a lesser extent the UK and the EU have to tread very carefully when they try and make the aid conditional, because it is seen as, you know, there they go again, the colonialists, they won't let go.
Yeah, but then it's also, that is also used as an excuse to repress certain vulnerable groups in any society, like women in Afghanistan, for instance. You can't tell us what to do with our women. This is our tradition. No, it's not. It's just brutal. Stop it.
Is there a real politic argument in favour of not sanctioning Uganda either, in that this could, if the United States and Western liberal democracies pull their plugs on Uganda, this is somewhere a much less squeamish superpower, like, for example, Russia or China, both of which are seeking to extend their influence in Africa, would be happy to set up shop?
Oh, I can see, as we speak, in the Putin press office, if such a thing exists, writing, you know, we agree the I think homosexuality is legal in Russia, but it is not very well tolerated. You could see Russia lining up with Uganda, saying, you know, this is Western imperialism and we support your right to take whatever views. We respect your local customs, I think, you know, the point you were making. So there is a certain geopolitical edge to this, which has to be taken into consideration.
Oh, is there, just finally on this, Lynn, is this one of those cases where there might be some utility to one of those more cosmetic but nevertheless potent sanctions if it is suggested to Uganda that there are Olympic Games occurring in Paris next year and you won't be coming?
I guess those sort of soft sanctions can also work because they hit national pride. Mm. I don't know what Uganda is good at.
Oh, very good at marathon 10,000, 5,000. Yeah. That would hit them bad because they're not great at soccer or cricket, but they're pretty good at athletics, and I think it would hit them hard. I think Andrew makes a good point there. I hope you haven't fed that idea to the White House because
they're listening.
they're welcome to it. We will move along. It has been usual throughout history in times of war for a country's soldiers to be esteemed as heroes. The subsequent acknowledgement that this may not have been exclusively the case is a relatively recent development. Earlier this week, Australia laid charges of murder against a decorated former member of its venerated Special Forces Regiment, the SAS, over the shooting of an Afghan man in Uruzgan province in 2012. This week, the UK launched its investigation into more than 50 alleged summary killings in Afghanistan by the British Army's SAS. Lynn, you reported extensively from Afghanistan over the period that foreign forces were operating there. How important are these developments, not only in establishing the truth of what actually happened, which is important, but applying some kind of justice? And I guess, will that mean anything in Afghanistan now?
I certainly think it will mean a lot to the people who are left behind, who were brutalised. You know, the Australian stuff kicked off with a program on Four Corners, an ABC current affairs program. And, you know, when this stuff came up today, I started watching it again. I watched it when it first came out. You know, this is the poorest place in the world, and these helicopters would land and these ninja turtles would drop from the sky and start shooting people and pulling them out of mud homes that had nothing in them. These terribly poor, brutalised people who had no defences. And there was a rogue unit within the Australian Special Forces, and war does do incredible things to young men who fight it. And I think that we're in an age of accountability where this really has to be dealt with, and there does have to be accountability in law. I think it's a good thing. I don't think it's opening a can of worms. I think it's doing the right thing for the people who fight wars, and it's humanising the people who are victimised by wars.
Iva, is this always going to be a particular problem to a degree that we have not yet addressed with special forces units in particular? Because the whole point of special forces units is that they are, well, it's not the whole point of them, but it's an inevitable aspect of their deployment, that they are largely unaccountable. They are often just turned loose in the field, left to their own devices to forage for themselves, make their own decisions, and carry out the orders as they see fit. Is it just down to the leadership of individuals in the field, or have we not addressed what the reality of their operations are?
Well, I just want to pick up one word used, which is unaccountable. I don't think they're unaccountable. They might be lacking transparency, but they're within the command of, in this case, the British Army, the British Armed Forces, who have rules of war. And although it is murky, if they are found to have broken the rules of war, they are as accountable as any other soldier.
Mm.
Now, that's uncomfortable. And I don't think, and here I speak as a complete non-military expert, but I don't think that should affect their modus operandi. I don't think that should affect what they do. But they have to be aware that they don't have a carte blanche to do what they like. And they have to be aware that ultimately there might be a price to pay. It's taken 10 years, both the Australian case and the British cases, to come out. So these things were not immediately obvious, but clearly it has to be painful but a good thing that a democracy is prepared to shine the spotlight on its own forces and say that's not acceptable.
I mean, is it good for the democracy as well, Lynn, and the citizens of it, that this does present possibly a more realistic idea of the reality of soldiering than they might have apprehended either from, you know, fictional representations or from the coverage they've seen while the war is going on, which does tend to be fairly supportive?
Yes, people will march in the streets against going to war, but once their boys and girls are in war, they will support them. And we saw that with Iraq. 1 million people walked in the streets of London, and then there was great support for the people who were fighting. But they're fighting on behalf of the country. They're representing the country that they're fighting for, and nobody wants to think that their boys are going over there representing their values and their democracy and who they are by shooting unarmed people. And while war has changed incredibly, post 9/11 wars are very, very different to the pre 9/11 wars, and Iraq and Afghanistan showed that the enemy is a different, you know, they're not wearing uniforms. One of the rules of law of war that Ivor mentioned is that you don't, you know, you show humanity, you don't shoot unarmed civilians. And yet in both of those wars, people were very wily and very clever in that they knew that they wouldn't be shot as unarmed civilians. And so they dropped their guns when they were so that sort of thing happened, and that is something that units have to get used to. But I think that in getting used to it and understanding the changing and change nature of war, wars will be fought better, and people will be more respected and can feel more protected. It's important.
Just briefly, Andrew, this story sits uncomfortably with the Prince Harry revelation a few months ago in his book that he allegedly killed 24, 26, and they weren't people for him.
25, he said. And actually, I don't agree with that, Ivor. I don't know anyone who doesn't know how many people, exactly how many people they've killed in war.
But
and every day, sitting in Kabul, running news organisations, I got body counts from both sides.
I wasn't questioning the numbers he killed. Yeah. I was questioning his subsequent statement. They weren't people to me. They were just targets. That was the controversial statement he made. And that sits uncomfortably with these sort of revelations. Did he know who he was killing? He clearly didn't, going back to the point you made.
Yeah, but nobody does, do they?
Well, and they weren't in uniform, and they might not have had weapons, and the whole... war is messy, as I don't need to tell you, and this highlights it.
And that's why it's a good thing.
Just finally on this, I want to ask you both, though, from the point of view of Britain and from the point of view of Australia, how most effectively can it be communicated to publics who, as Lynn was pointing out, no one enjoys hearing this about their own soldiers? How can these sorts of things be communicated and make it clear that this is a search for justice, this is not some sort of post hoc score settling or blame shifting?
Well, it's very difficult. I mean, one of the when I was a reporter, one of my most emotional moments I remember was when soldiers were going to after the Falklands War, going to interview soldiers when they came off the plane, and I didn't have strong feelings, but it was quite emotional seeing these young boys as they were coming back, having been through hell. So it's really difficult, Andrew, to get a population to disengage itself from the individuals and step back. But it's necessary. It has to be done. There's no easy ways. I can't suggest, if they did this, it would be easy. It ain't easy. But, you know, not everything in a democracy is easy.
Well, indeed not. And Lynn, in Australia, there is a very high-profile libel case underway in Australian courts now. Australia's most decorated soldier, indeed, of recent years, Ben Robert Smith, also of the SAS, is conducting a lawsuit against people who have made allegations of this nature against him. But he and most Australian soldiers certainly, I think, can start from a default position of huge public sympathy. And does that make it difficult to get investigations like this up and running and to get their conclusions to be absorbed?
Well, the investigations didn't begin until the revelations were made public by, you know, ABC television. And so, yeah, I think that there has to be a real push. The government has to be, and the military establishment have to be made aware of their responsibilities to the electorate, to the population, and to the fighting people. They are also owed this sort of investigation that raises standards and maintains standards. There are rules of law for a reason, and if people break them, then they have to be punished, I think.
As maybe one day in the future, President Putin will discover having broken just about every rule of law in Ukraine.
Well, and now, with due acknowledgement that journalists making fun of AI may be akin to dinosaurs pointing and giggling at that big ball of fire in the sky, which seems to be getting closer and closer, there is concern, if largely among angry weirdos on the internet, that such AI tools as OpenAI's ChatGPT have an inbuilt liberal bias. But first, by way of testing the basic accuracy of these things, we conducted an experiment. We asked ChatGPT to furnish biographies of our two panellists today and the host. And Lynn, to my considerable surprise and, frankly, discombobulation, which I'm sure you will share, I discover that we are both, in fact, British.
I'm also 6'2".
You should feel very proud to be admitted to the ranks of the Brits. Welcome, welcome.
Well, I mean, Ivy, your people had your chance where my forebears were concerned, and you threw us all out for stealing shirts.
Sheep, not shirts.
Actually, it was shirts in the case of one of my ancestors. It was, in fairness, sheep in another one.
We're going to let bygones be bygones and allow you to come in.
My criminal background does not appear in my ChatGPT biography, but the allegation that I have been a radio presenter and host for the ABC and the BBC does. Neither of those things are true, though I have, in fairness, appeared on both. It says I've written for Rolling Stone. I haven't, but, you know,
You wanted to.
Exactly. They know where to find me.
Is there anything about you that's correct?
Not really. It says I'm also a musician. People who've heard me play the guitar might dispute that. They say I've played in the Australian band The Herd, of whom, funnily enough, I have never heard. I don't even know if they're a thing. But so I'm not altogether concerned about being made redundant by a chatbot just yet. Lynn, yours is, in fairness, a bit more accurate, I think. New York Times, Guardian, Al Jazeera English, covered major events, fall of the Taliban, Iraq War, Arab Spring. Quite impressive, actually, yours. Won several awards for your reporting, it says here.
That's wrong, actually.
You haven't?
Just the one.
Hang on. Which one do you not have? It says including the Kurt Schork Award and the Amnesty International Media Award.
Oh, so...
You've got neither of those.
Yeah, so...
What have you
got? They've left out my Pulitzer? My Oscar and my BAFTA are not there?
No, unfortunately. I mean, they will be once AI listens to this episode. Have you not won either the Kurt Schork or the Amnesty?
I've won one of those.
Which one?
The Amnesty one.
Which is an impressive thing to have won.
I was impressed.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm impressed. I hope it hasn't got my awards because it'd be a very short.
Ivor, I think yours is pretty much on the money, extensively on media ethics, political communication, authored or edited several books, including political campaigning, elections and the internet. This is just a massive plug for both our panellists now.
never written that one.
You didn't write that one.
I meant to.
Okay.
You will.
did you write British political parties and the media in the wake of the news?
No.
No.
This is, again, it's the sort of thing I do write, not those particular combinations of words.
Are you now, I feel like I should be shining a light in your face at this point. Are you now or have you ever been a consultant to the BBC and the Electoral Commission providing expertise on media coverage of campaigns and elections, or a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts and a member of the European Media Management Association?
Well, that was almost correct, except that last one I've never heard of.
I'm not even sure that's a thing. So basically, before we get into the idea of bias in AI, are we all pretty confident our jobs are safe for the moment off the back of this?
Now, this is very comforting to me, who's anticipating student essays written by this. If they're as good as this, I will be able to spot them.
but the real talking point here is this perverted fantasy on the part of certain extremely online conservatives, Lynn, that AI has a natural liberal bias. There is talk about attempting to build a conservative chatbot. I'm sure that can only go well. Is there likely to be anything to this, or, as is often the case with the discourse online, this is just people projecting furiously?
Well, create the possibility and you create the inevitability, I guess. And deep fakes are already in use. So, yeah, why not? I think it will be put to nefarious use if it's not already. Yeah,
I think it
very
is already
soon.
There you go. I mean, we do have a real problem with fake news, however you want to define it, and this is just going to make it even easier to fake.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a partial answer to the question I wanted to ask you finally, Ivor, which is basically not necessarily us as journalists, but are we as a society entirely doomed? Because this is developing incredibly quickly, this technology, and though we joke about it now in much the same way that we might have joked in the early 90s about phones the size of a house brick, which couldn't get a signal further than 10 metres, four or five, not probably a matter of months from now, this is going to be a whole other thing.
Yeah, we've all lived through, this is going to be another thing and it doesn't happen, but then sometimes it does. I always, many moons ago, used to get freaked out when I was, say, standing. I remember in having a physiotherapy session, going to the reception to book my new appointment, and she said, can you do 10:30 next Thursday? And I looked down at my iPhone, and their fate, you know, ready for me to click. It's already put it into my diary, you know, because it's listening. And I, you know, that small thing freaked me out. On the other hand, you know, people were very concerned about the nefarious impact of, oh goodness me, I can't remember the thing that you talk to, and it says, "Hey, so and so,
Alexa."
Ooh. Around the world, Alexas are hanging on my every word. Hey, Alexa, keep tuned to Monocle Radio.
Is brilliant. Does that work? Alexa, stay tuned to Monocle Radio and never stop, never switch it off. Play it in perpetuity. Well,
but there is a true story about that. In a small town in America, all of a sudden, virtually every household in the cable station area started to receive deliveries of doll's houses, because on air an interviewer had said to somebody, so is it true that when you said to Alexa, deliver the Amazon dollhouse, it happened? Of course, it might well be one of those journalistic myths. But what I'm struggling to say is these things are totally unpredictable. So the thing hurtling towards the dinosaur did actually have an impact, but other things hurtling to Earth so far have not. So the answer is, I don't know.
Well, on that note, Ivor Gaber and Lynn O'Donnell, thank you both very much for joining us. Finally on today's show, it is time for our letter from New York City. Here is Henry Rhys Sheridan.
This week, New Yorkers have been riled by a new logo. It's a revamp of the classic iHeartNY logo that you see everywhere. There are two main differences between the old version of the logo and the new one. First, while the original said iHeartNY, the new one says WeHeartNYC to make it specific to New York City. Second, while the old one is good, the new one is rubbish. What's weird is that at the highest level of abstraction, the logos are basically the same thing. Both feature a personal pronoun, then a heart emoji, then a geographic initialism. But while the original design got every element just right, the new one has had its parameters carefully tweaked to make it as naff as possible. In the original, the pronoun is an I. This enables anyone looking at it to seamlessly identify with the statement, and significantly, it makes complete sense when printed on a t-shirt or any other item of clothing designed to be worn by a single person at a given time. But the new logo uses the pronoun we. This is meant to convey and encourage solidarity between New Yorkers, but it makes it hard to identify with. Who is we? And it doesn't really make sense to print on merch.
No one will ever beat New Yorkers down. And we took the I out of I love New York and we brought the we. We're in this together.
That's right. It's not I anymore, it's we, as in we can't afford rent.
Back to the original, the typeface used there is a classic American typewriter font, evocative of New York's industrial energy and cultural clout. But in the new logo, the font is a bland sans serif, meant to evoke the Helvetica typeface used on the city's subway, but which ends up evoking nothing at all. In the original logo, the heart is a simple, flat, block red symbol, like a child might draw. In the new logo, the heart is a weirdly shaded, 3D-looking emoji. It's distractingly odd. Most of the criticism of the new logo has concerned itself with design specifics like these, and there's plenty to criticize there. But I think there's a deeper reason why the logo is so upsetting. What is the new logo actually trying to achieve? The organization behind it is called, appropriately, We Love NYC. I paid a visit to their website, welovenyc.nyc.
We love that don't walk. It's just a suggestion.
We love a dollar slice.
We love that a cyclone at Coney Island.
On the organization's About page, it explains the thinking behind the new logo. It points out that the original I Heart New York campaign was launched in 1977 in the midst of an urban crisis and draws parallels between then and now. It goes on to say the original logo's aim was to, quote, reignite the can-do optimism of New Yorkers, to mobilize volunteer action to build a safer, cleaner, more prosperous city, and to ensure that New York City would remain a great place to live, work, and visit. Now, it's true the original logo was released in 1977 in the midst of an urban crisis, but almost none of the other stuff is true. In fact, the original I Heart NY campaign had nothing to do with the city of New York. It was commissioned by the New York State Department of Commerce as part of a tourism campaign to encourage visitors to places in New York outside of New York City. The slogan was even incorporated into a TV ad directly targeted at people from New York City, or at least Brooklyn.
But I love New York.
I live in North Carolina, but I love New York.
Call toll-free for our free 100-page vacation guide. It's filled with affordable vacation packages and ideas. Find out why outdoor lovers from the Carolinas to Canada love New York.
I live in Brooklyn, but I love New York.
The phrase I Heart NY remains the intellectual property of the New York State Department of Economic Development, who gave the city permission to revamp the phrase for its new campaign. The new campaign's main goal seems to be encouraging New Yorkers to get involved in various civic volunteer programs to improve quality of life in the city. A page on the site labeled Do Something lists local non-profits you can sign up to work for. All these organizations do good work, and I don't want to criticize them at all. But considering the new We Heart NYC campaign is asking New Yorkers to go above and beyond to help their city, it's ironic that so little effort has been put into the campaign itself. The organization took out a full-page ad in the New York Times on Monday. The headline read, Help Wanted, Must Be Tough, Demanding, Impatient, Diehard, and Overly Ambitious. The new logo is the very antithesis of these descriptors. It's a brazenly recycled idea.
That was Henry Ree Sheridan and his in-house jazz band in New York City. That is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Lynn O'Donnell and Ivor Gaber, also to Chris Lord at the top of the show. Today's show was produced by Laura Kramer and researched by Andre Nikolai Pamantuan. Our sound engineer was Callum McLean. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.